Thank you for coming this evening. Tonight we're going to be discussing escapism. Now, often people think that it's not good to escape. Unless you're running out of a burning house, or running away from a forest fire, or trying to outrun a tsunami. Otherwise, people think you shouldn't try to run away from your problems. Now, tonight we're going to be talking about a perfect escape. In other words, let us not be blind to the possibility that some kind of escapism is good. In other words, there's nothing wrong with fleeing a bad situation. Now, often people will reply, why should you flee a bad situation if you're just taking the problem with you? In other words, you yourself are the problem. And that is correct. But a perfect escape means that you realize you yourself are the problem, and therefore you make your escape by thoroughly dealing with yourself so that you're no longer creating problematic situations. Now, you may be surprised to know that frequently persons who take up Krishna consciousness are often misunderstood by others. I know one example. One of our staff members here was visited by her friends. By that time, they were all in their mid-20s. So her friends were looking very miserable and acknowledged that they were very miserable. They freely admitted, we are miserable. And they said to her, you look happy, without a doubt. And there's no doubt we are miserable. But you have escaped, and we have chosen to go through the misery. They freely admitted, we're miserable. But they thought there was some special prestige to sticking to being miserable. So much so that they could say to someone who had found a solution, found a way to get out of misery, that this is not the best thing. You should have just stuck with misery and worked through it. I leave that with you to think about. A perfect escape is based on knowledge, not sentiment. Just like when you run out of a burning building, you have knowledge. I shouldn't stay here. It's hazardous for my health. The longer I delay my escape, the more problems I'm going to create. Now, there may be some attachment. You may feel a bond with things that are in the burning house, even persons that are in the burning house. But ultimately, your knowledge should tell you, you've got to get out of here for your own good. I'm remembering, for example, during the World Trade Center disaster, September 11th, many people reported that when the smoke was filling their offices after the planes struck each building, and it was quite obvious something was horribly wrong. And they were told, leave, leave, leave now. Begin the long walk downstairs from the 80th floor, the 70th floor. Many persons instinctively began to gather their computers, and desktop computers with their life's work on it, and try to, we got to take these with us. And even their supervisors telling them, just go, we got to get out of here. And they They were still wrestling with the, you know, it's got all our financial data, all our important information for our company. We just can't leave. This is an interesting example that shows you human nature, how human beings can become attached to anything. They were feeling responsibility, obligation. How can we just leave all this crucial data for our financial investment firm? It wasn't their firm, they're just employees. But still, they thought, we've got to wrestle with this somehow and take it down 70 flights of stairs. So that shows you how human beings can become very attached to their situation, even when it contradicts their best interest. A perfect escape doesn't mean irresponsibility. A perfect escape means you have clear understanding that I'm in a place, I'm in a situation where I shouldn't be. The whole thing is a mistake. And the quicker I make a correction, a total adjustment, the better. A perfect escape is based on knowledge. And through knowledge, one gets experience. Through spiritual knowledge, if it's genuine, you should get genuine spiritual experience. All right, let's move ahead a bit. Yes, we've already been discussing practical psychology. People think this is the appropriate mentality to have. Can you all see that, by the way, on the bottom? Yeah. Today I expect the best. That's quite all right, yes? Why not? Say, I expect the best for me. The best for me means the best for my senses. When we wake up in the morning, we ask ourselves that question. How is the day going to be for me and my senses? We have that expectation, and so therefore, why not have the highest expectations for me? Today I expect maximum for me. Can you feel that in your chest? Today I expect the maximum for me. I can do anything. Maybe some of you have recited these affirmations. Anyway, I can do anything. I don't know the extent of my powers. I don't know how high my achievements will be. Oh, here's my favorite one. I forgive myself completely. I'm at peace. I'm at peace with myself. I forgive myself. As if we are the supreme authority in the cosmos and we can, we can be the criminal, the judge, and the jury all for ourselves. I forgive myself completely. Can you imagine? You've committed a crime. You've burgled someone's home or you've assaulted someone. And they haul you into, the police bring you to court. You look at the judge and say, with a big smile, I forgive myself completely. It's not going to work. But why do we think it's going to work in terms of the reactions to our actions? But no one knows the whole system of action and reaction. And no one cares. We think that it's all up to me how I feel. If I feel good about something, it's good. If I feel bad about something, it's bad. We don't understand that we're just a tiny part of a whole and that we get reactions for our actions. We've never inquired, most of us have never inquired into what is the overall system for. Deciding what reactions we get for our actions. It's okay for me to have all I want. Or else we say, not that I'm greedy, but it's okay for me to have most of what I want. That's a legitimate aspiration. Now, it's never considered that maybe I don't know what I want. Maybe I don't know what is good for me. And naturally, we're all very busy acquiring, objecting, complaining. We all have things to do, places to go, money to make, sex to enjoy. So don't burden us with too much reflection. Why should you worry so much and think so much and reflect so much when you have these prime human responsibilities? Do things, go places, make money, enjoy sex. These are the prime responsibilities. How dare you escape from this? How dare you think that there's something else? Now, a perfect escape or an ordinary escape? Ordinary escape is no escape at all. It means out of the frying pan into the fire. Or, another example, if you're feeling a burden on one shoulder, you think you've solved the problem by transferring the burden to the other shoulder. This is a good way to look at materialistic progress. You make one technological breakthrough and it causes newer problems. So, a perfect escape is one that actually causes a improvement in all aspects of our being in terms of the higher principles of life. There has to be some discrimination. Otherwise, we'll not know how to evaluate what we're doing. Is this course of action I'm taking, is it beneficial for me now in the future? Or is it beneficial just for now? Or actually, if it's not beneficial for the future, it's not even beneficial for now. But that takes some knowledge to understand. For a perfect escape, you need the answers to these questions. What are you? What are you a part of? Why are you here? Where you have been? Where are you going? These questions, although simply phrased, take a huge amount of time and energy in our life. Therefore, someone who is actually serious about their self-development, they set aside significant chunks of their life for dealing with these most important priorities. But as long as we obliterate ourselves, drown ourselves in false busyness, acquiring things, acquiring relationships like objects, we'll never be able to turn over the necessary time in our life for the most important priorities. Okay. Some of you out here, I know, you long for definitive spiritual knowledge. I just want to know something that's for real. I don't want anything vague. I want comprehensive, in-depth, specific spiritual knowledge. Others, probably not here, they feel they don't have to find all the answers. So what if you don't know? Life goes on. You may know a little something, you may not. But just have a good feeling in your heart and in your belly and in other places, and then everything will be all right. So what is your preference? You'll get a chance to choose. How do you like this one? Is this your size of shoes? All those who said, yep, that's where I'm at, please raise your hand. Okay, one. There. Any other? It sounds good, doesn't it? Pretty easy. Yeah, the soul doesn't want explanations. It wants constant rumination, nuances, interpretations without end. Never a final solution to anything. We never have to have the answers. That's again the illusion. The soul doesn't need that. It can live with ambiguity. Let me ask though, with all respect for your honest answer. How many of you can really live in this way? You can't live with ambiguity. You want something concrete and definitive for your senses, if not for your mind. No one wants a life without answers. You don't, no one lives like that. You want something that you can latch on to. Money in the bank, relationships, things to do, places to go, nothing ambiguous. You want specific things for your senses. So why is it then that when we consider the ultimate questions in life, we would think, oh, yes, this is very poetic. That's where I'm at. I don't need answers. Of course you need answers. I wonder, when you're, let's say you're trying to establish a relationship with someone. Well, what do you think? Seems that we're resonating very nicely together. And the person says to you, we never have to have the answers. That's the illusion. We can live with ambiguity. You wouldn't go with that at all. Wait a minute, let's just try to connect here now. No. Endless nuances and interpretations without end. Never a final solution to anything. This is not working out. So, let's bear that in mind. Now, we have a beautiful quote from Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna is speaking. My dear Arjuna, because you are never envious of me, I shall impart to you this most confidential knowledge and realization, knowing which you shall be relieved of the miseries of material existence. Now you notice that Lord Krishna doesn't say, I'm going to ask you to believe in something. I'm going to ask you to have faith. No, Lord Krishna says, I'm going to give you knowledge and experience. And through that knowledge and experience, realization, you're going to be relieved of the miseries of material existence. So that's very focused, very straightforward. So, everyone's entitled to their preference, though. Now, we're going to be turning to an ancient Vedic literature, Srimad Bhagavatam, one of our main texts here. And we're going to be looking at a history from what's called the fifth canto. And before getting into that spiritual history, let's reflect upon what a genuine spiritual text should deliver to us. It should teach us about consciousness, how we can perfect that consciousness, and the source of that consciousness. So Srimad Bhagavatam deals with the finite consciousness, the living entity, and it deals with the supreme consciousness. So, once you can understand and experience the relationship between the limited consciousness and the unlimited consciousness, then you're well situated on the path of spiritual development. Most people make the mistake of thinking, because I have a little bit of understanding that I have consciousness, therefore I'm spiritual. But that's just a tiny beginning. We need to understand the relationship between our limited consciousness and the supreme consciousness. Even sometimes people confuse the two. Oh, I realize I'm conscious, and my conscious is spiritual. Therefore, I'm the supreme. Well, that's up, huh? No. Okay. We're going on a bit of an adventure. It involves an ancient marmot in India named Rabhugana. And he's going on a palanquin. How many of you know what a palanquin is? Please raise your hands. Okay. It's like a mobile throne. You've probably seen it, pictures of it in movies about the Middle East or India. A prestigious person sits on this throne, like a portable chair, and then, like, persons carry the chair on their shoulders. So, the king is going about on this. And he finds that he's short one laborer. He's got maybe a party of six who are shouldering the mobile throne. And he says, not going fast enough. We need another laborer to make the journey easier. So he sees a fresh recruit. The recruit's name is Judpar. The king immediately notices, who is this fine physical specimen over here? He looks perfect to help carry my throne. Now, there are two possible visions of the same person. This fresh recruit looks one way to a materially tainted person, and he looks another way to a spiritually enlightened person. So, to the ordinary eyes of someone who can only see mundane things, indeed, the fresh recruit, Judpar, looks like a perfect brute for physical labor. He's young, he's strong, he's brawny, he's muscular. He's looking like, perfect athlete, perfect physical laborer, in perfect shape. So that's what the king sees. Oh, look at this. Just right for carrying me. So, since he's the king, he can conscript labor. So immediately does it. You're drafted. Help. Join the team. Carry my mobile throne. But to enlighten vision, you'll be able to see that Judpar is he's an extraordinary transcendentalist. He's deeply absorbed in Krishna consciousness. Although he looks one way from the physical point of view, from the spiritual point of view, he's another way. Now, okay, he's pressed into service for carrying the palanquin with the king on it. But with each step he takes, he checks the ground to see, are there any ants? Now, obviously, the other palanquin bearers, the other team members, aren't doing that. They're just walking forward, carrying the king on their shoulders in his chair. So, you can understand that with just one laborer out of step, the whole thing, the whole ride becomes quite jerky and... Yeah. And so obviously the king riding on top, he's wondering, well, what's going on here? And being a regal person, obviously, he can be very short on temper. So the palanquin is jerking and shaking. You might wonder, why is Judpar, who we will know as an enlightened person, why is he walking like that? Why does he just walk like the other laborers? But he's thinking, all living entities are equal. I should be compassionate to all creatures, not just my house pets, as is generally the standard today. So many people are very kind to their pets, but when it comes to eating, if it swims, walks, flies, or crawls, they'll eat it. But to their pet, they're very affectionate for their pet. But a genuine spiritualist, as Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, sees all living entities as equal. That doesn't mean he thinks they're equal physically. Every body is different. Some bodies are stronger. Some bodies are more intelligent. It's like even amongst men and women. Who here will say that men and women have equal bodies? Anyone? What do you think? Yeah. Anyone? Men and women are equal physically? No. I don't know any men here who can have babies. Any?
So,
Still, the men cannot deliver a child, nor can the women father a child. So, my point is, bodies are better or worse at various things. So, it's not that the genuine spiritualist sees that the bodies are equal. That's not true. But he sees that the spirit soul within the body is equal, regardless of the differences in the body. He sees that spiritually everyone is equal. Everyone is equal as a part of Krishna, spiritual spark, part of Krishna. So that is the equality that Jagbhar was seeing. Therefore, he's thinking, why should I step on these ants? They're tiny. Their bodies are not equal to a human's body in magnitude, but within them is the spirit soul, just like what is within a human body. And the spirit soul is equal. So I'm going to respect all living entities. Why should I, while I'm walking, just ignore the ants, as the other laborers are doing? No. He's very careful as he's carrying the pallet. Oh, can't step there. Oh. So it's throwing the whole seat, it's throwing the whole maneuver out of sync. And we'll see the king's reaction. So we should, as you can read here, understand the difference between modern humanitarianism and real spiritual culture. It's modern humanitarianism means if the body type is very close to me, then I'll care for it. But otherwise, I won't. That means I'll care for my family members, or I'll care for the people from my same country. Even I'll care for all human beings. But how to care for all living entities? No one knows that. Now, one thing we should bear in mind, the king should have understood this. He should have been equipped with knowledge to know that he, as king, is not just king of the human beings. This is the ancient Vedic standard for a government head. That if you're prime minister, president, or whatever, it's not simply the human beings who are citizens. All creatures in your land are citizens, and you have to be responsible for their welfare, otherwise you get karma. So let's just say if you were Prime Minister of New Zealand, you would be karmically responsible for all the creatures in New Zealand. That means all the creatures who go through the slaughterhouse, you are karmically responsible for. Not just the human beings, or not just the members of the Labour Party or the National Party, not just those who have citizenship papers, but all creatures in New Zealand, you're the Prime Minister, you are karmically responsible for them. So this idea that I'm just the leader of the human beings, this is very unenlightened, very unadvanced. It's actually, from the Vedic point of view, considered barbaric. So, the king, like any modern government leader, had his primary concerns. You have a normal program. He's an ordinary guy. Few would criticize him today. He seems like he's got the basic goals in life understood. But from the viewpoint of Srimad Bhagavatam, he's quite deficient. Now, here's a point to consider. Just see how Jug Bart, this recruited laborer who's actually a great transcendentalist, just see how he's thinking. Why are the king's goals more important than the ants' objectives? The ants are eating, sleeping, having sex, and defending themselves. The king is eating, sleeping, having sex, and defending himself. So, Jagbhar, the recruited laborer, is thinking, why should I step on the ants just for the sake of the king's smooth ride, when there's no difference in quality between the ants' objectives and the king's objectives? Requires some contemplation at this point. Because ordinarily, we'll think, oh, ants, what are they? Tiny creatures doing little tiny affairs. Human beings are also tiny creatures doing tiny affairs when seen from the viewpoint of entities who are far more powerful than human beings. Just because we don't know about them, maybe, doesn't mean they don't exist. The ants could just dismiss the human beings. We don't know about them. We've got so much important business to do in our ant colonies. So when the human beings say, we don't know about any entities more powerful than us. We've got so much important business to do in our beehive or in our, in our cities and country. So, the Vedic conclusion is that if the human being neglects to use his or her special gift of advanced consciousness, then the human being is no better than an animal. Because humans and animals share the four basic activities. Eating, sleeping, having sex, and defending yourself against attack. If the human being doesn't rise above these pursuits, no matter how luxuriantly decorated, then the human being is an animal. All right. Now we're going to look at this recruited palanquin carrier, mobile chair bearer, Judd Bard. He seems quite clumsy, because we know he's not stepping on the ants and all the other workers there. They couldn't care less. So, naturally the king has a reaction. He's angry. He's jerking, bouncing up and down, and what's going on? Why aren't these brutes properly bearing it? And the laborers, obviously they're afraid. Oh, the king is angry. Will be chastised. Now, you might say, well, obviously they're unfortunate members of a politically repressive regime. but I'm sure so many of you have had the experience of being very fearful of your boss at work. Oh, am I going to get terminated? Am I going to be fired? This fear is there. Everywhere, because there's always someone who has more material power than you. That's always going to be there. Always someone is going to be stronger materially and weaker materially. So therefore, there's always going to be fear. So the laborers, they were afraid. Oh, we're going to be chastised, we're going to be dealt with severely just because of this clumsy new recruit who's walking in such a way that he shakes the whole palanquin simply because he wants to avoid ants. How sentimental he is. Doesn't he understand that he's putting us in a bad situation? Doesn't he understand he's making us all look like we're fools and we'll be punished? Who cares for the ants? Think of us. So, in this case, the king, he's compromised his integrity and abandoned his principles. Because he actually should know better. He had some training in basic spiritual knowledge. But he's caught up with his prestige. He's caught up with pragmatics. I want to go from point A to point B in the most appropriate manner for someone of my position and title. That is the most important thing right now. So even though he actually had some good training as a youth in spiritual ethics, in Vedic knowledge, he just took leave of that. I'm sure many of you have that experience, that in a tight situation, you'll abandon your own personal principles. Yes? Sometimes it happens. You say, oh, anyway, just do it. Got to be flexible. What's wrong with just going off the deep end for one night? Yeah? Can't be too bad. Not every night, but just one night, you know? I don't want to be repressed. I don't want to be, you know, fuss-budgety like an old man or old lady. Yeah, I have my scruples. I have my standards. But anyway, let's just see what happens tonight. So, similarly, the king was doing like that. He had leadership skills, no doubt. He was actually a very materially qualified executive chief. But he was blind to the spiritual effulgence, the spiritual radiance that was right before his eyes. So therefore, he's a very smart man, very materially competent. he used the traditional weapon of sarcasm, laced with false humility. He's going to question his new recruit who's making the palanquin bounce up and down. Very eloquent he is. "My dear brother, I know you must be quite weary, because for quite a while now, you alone have carried this palanquin over great distances. Alas, I see that the effects of time are besetting you. Because of old age, your body is thin and frail. Can't you get the other carriers to cooperate with your valiant struggle?" Of course, as you see, this is all opposite from what is true. Dunbar has just been freshly recruited, so he hasn't carried the palanquin over a great distance, nor is he carrying it alone as a whole team. And as for the effects of time, Dunbar is a young man in the prime of youth, and he's not thin and frail. He's quite muscular and strong. And so the king is just speaking in this sarcastic way. No response from Dunbar, so the king loses it. "You idiot, where's your brain? Are you a walking dead body? Remember, I am your master, the people's executive head. How dare you disregard me and in this way flaunt the law and order of our state? I'll have you beaten, and then you'll certainly come to your senses." So, the king dispensed with all his false eloquence and just got cut to the chase and got right to the point. Because he got no response from Dunbar. The king thought, "I've spoken reasonably with appropriate sarcasm, and I got no response." So now he's got a threat. He's just, in other words, he takes off the gloves and says, "Look, you brute, you better get it together." Now, what is the understanding of Dunbar, this apparently brutish laborer? Actually, he's fully absorbed in Krishna consciousness, fully absorbed in spiritual knowledge. First of all, he knows the body is a vehicle that's molded under the influence of past karma and desires. So the king's taunts don't affect him. Dunbar is thinking, this is all an external situation coming to me coming to me as a reaction to things I did in the past. It's affecting my body, but I'm not the body. So why should I even respond? In other words, my body is not me. It's a consequence of things I did in the past. It's a material shell. The king can talk about my body all he wants, but it's got nothing to do with me, because I am the spirit soul, part of Krishna, the supreme soul. So why didn't the king recognize Dunbar? He's so sharp and shrewd and politically astute. What's going on? In Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna explains that there are such things as the modes of material nature, in Sanskrit known as gunas. These modes of material nature blind the living entity in different ways. There's goodness, passion, and ignorance. Basically, mode of goodness means you are very clean and self-controlled person who's very careful and fastidious about living in this temporary material world. You actively cultivate genuine knowledge at every step, and you live very simply, and you are totally free from agitation, and your senses are completely controlled. You're an expert in purified living. You don't see this mode of goodness very often these days. Then, what you have common is passion and ignorance. Passion means, I've got to acquire, I've got to get, I've got to please my senses. I'm going to work, I'm going to struggle, I'm going to enjoy, I'm going to party hard. And that inevitably leads to ignorance, because from passionate desire comes frustration, because you're never satisfied by passionate desire. You're always disappointed. So then, intoxication is necessary. Intoxication is the mode of ignorance. So, what happens on a Friday evening after all the offices close in Wellington? Where do people line up at? Huh? Where are the long lines? Haven't you seen 5, 6 o'clock? Friday, Wellington? Long lines at the package stores, at the liquor stores. Because they know, for a successful weekend, there must be passion and ignorance. There's going to be parties, there's going to be clubbing, and to dull the brain so that you forget, there has to be intoxication. So these are the two pillars of Western so-called civilization now, passion and ignorance. I was talking to a medical student in the UK recently. We're having a program at the University of Manchester where our Tara is from, if you know her. So I was asking the students, what do you do on a Friday night? They all looked at me like I was crazy. What do we do on a Friday night? Yeah. We go to a club and we get blasted. I said, okay, fine. And then how do you feel the next morning? These are future doctors, lawyers, engineers, the upstanding people of society, the pillars of society. So how do you feel the next morning? Horrible. Some of them, why do you spend Friday night this way? I said, well, what does it matter? We were happy for a few hours. So what if we suffer the whole next 2 days? And they said that, like, I was supposed to accept it as an intelligent proposition. We got 2 hours, 3 hours of happiness. So what if all Saturday and Sunday we got a splitting headache? We partied. We did it. And then they told me the ultimate achievement was if you would wake up on a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning and see someone next to you and not know how that person got there. That you really got bragging rights come Monday. Yeah. Guess what? I was totally out of it. And then I woke up in the morning and, oops, there was someone next to me. I didn't even remember how they got there. They were like, ah! So this is passion and ignorance. This king had some training in real knowledge, but he had become overwhelmed by his position, and therefore he was susceptible to the modes of passion and ignorance. He couldn't reflect clearly. Clear reflection is the gift of the mode of goodness. That's the highest level of material living. But because the king was identifying with his body and his position, he was in passionate ignorance. So, in this story, in this episode, you can see that indeed there's an incompatibility, which cannot be erased, between advanced spiritualists and materialists. They see things differently, and I think you would agree it's good they see things differently. But please recognize there's always going to be this incompatibility, conflict, disagreement. Lord Krishna himself points that out in Bhagavad Gita. He says that what is night for the transcendentalist is day for the materialist, and vice versa. That's the way it's always going to be. So if any of you are aspiring transcendentalists, you're just going to have to accept that this basic incompatibility is going to be there. It's just a fact of existence. So, we already spoke about the king, Rahugana's problem. I am this body. I am my position. I am the boss. I am the CEO. I'm the prime minister. Now, we all know how animals are simply led around by the cycles of nature. But if a human being is like that, then how is the human life more valuable? Okay, let's hear from this so-called laborer, this so-called brute who's been pressed into service to carry the executive head's palanquin. Oh, great leader, although you certainly don't realize it, all your sarcastic words to me contain the real truth. Your Excellency, you have correctly implied that I have not exerted myself while carrying your palanquin. My dear hero, you are right. I am not the bearer of your traveling chair. The body is doing the work. Please note for sure that I do not identify with the body, hence its loads don't belong to me, the pure self. Isn't that brilliant? How he turned the words around completely. Remember the king that lashed out at him, you know, with sarcasm. Oh, I see that you're laboring very hard, which is a long time. You're carrying all alone. And that you're very old and very frail. So Jug Bark is going to take all those words and just spin them around. You're right. I haven't carried anything. The load doesn't belong to me. The load belongs to my body. You're right. I'm not the bearer of your traveling chair. It's my body who's doing the work. I haven't exerted myself at all. I, the spirit soul, am aloof from all this activity. Then he goes on. Furthermore, you've implied that I am neither strong nor muscular. Once again, unknowingly, you have hit the nail right on the head. One's original spiritual identity is not frail, stout, fat, or thin. Finally, your irony reveals that I have no right to feel troubled by my brief, ineffectual career as your carrier. How true this is. The purpose of the royal journey and the road it's taking are not mine. They pertain to my body, not me. Consequently, I have no problem. Indeed, good sir, I can truly say, no worries. Isn't that brilliant? He just totally turned the whole situation around. Yes, I've got nothing to do with this. This is all external. This is a bodily affair. It's got nothing to do with my spiritual identity. Now, we should have some background information to Jug Bar's brilliant statements. We should know, and this is explained in Bhagavad Gita, that the physical and mental pains and pleasures are just permutations, transformations, mutations, changes of the layers covering the self, the pure self, which is spirit soul. So you'll never understand this unless you lead a life of sensory discipline, a life of controlling the senses. And this is what is missing in the so-called spiritual endeavors of people today. They think it's all about adopting the right theory or adopting the right trendy notion, but no one knows anything about how to live a lifestyle of controlled senses. This is the farthest thing from everyone's mind. In fact, people think, just do whatever you like, and it all works for you. You just flow with the universe flows through you, and then somehow or other, you just grow into perfection. Have you seen it happening? Maybe some of you even thought like that. And you know, it didn't happen. The same old impulses control you, enslave you. The same old emptiness, the same old actual loneliness. Honest people admit they're lonely. All still there. That's because we don't know how to adjust our lifestyle, overhaul our lifestyle, manage our lifestyle, so that we can become masters of our mind and senses, and then, and only then, can we see clearly what is the spiritual reality. So, as you see, trendy books and magazines don't help without a practical lifestyle of, and these are dreaded words, purification, regulation. Ooh, they're scary words. Can you imagine calling up some of your friends? Hey, guess what? I realized that in my life I need purification and regulation. You're mad. Where's your brain? I have one spirituality. He wrote in his book that when you're choosing a spiritual path, whatever you do, don't choose a path that has a lot of regulations and rules for controlling your senses. Because these rules and regulations, they will press down on your shoulders and prevent you from spiritually floating upwards. He's a very popular author. I'm not going to tell you his name. Very popular. You'd be shocked if I told you his name. He said like that. Huh? Don't let spiritual disciplines push down on you, because that will block your natural float upwards to spiritual perfection. In fact, one person came here totally brokenhearted and devastated, because this author was her hero. And when she was in Hawaii, she went to a pub, and there was her favorite author getting smashed in a pub, surrounded by his friends. And in his drunkenness, he was just boasting, "I'm making millions of dollars, I'm selling millions of books, and I write complete junk." She was just stunned. So anyway, these things are going on. So let's get back to Jud Barr for some real knowledge. Now, Jud Barr is going to give a commentary to his very pithy answers. "O worshipable monarch, you called me a walking dead man. I can only reply that you have touched upon an inherent truth. Since you think I am nothing more than the material body, then you should certainly conclude that all living entities are dead, even when manifesting symptoms of life. Everything material has a beginning and an end, so why should we be overly fascinated by the temporary appearance of life symptoms?" Think about that. Yes, you say I'm a walking dead man. In a sense, that's true. The body comes from Earth, and when the spirit soul leaves at the time of death, the body returns to Earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. So, looked at in a certain way, yes, the living entities are dead in that their body has no lasting existence. It temporarily manifests the symptoms of life. Let's hear Krishna's words from Bhagavad Gita, because Jud Barr is echoing Lord Krishna's statement in Bhagavad Gita about recycling. We don't simply recycle bottles, we also recycle bodies. And Krishna is going to refer to body recycling in Bhagavad Gita. He says, "All created beings are unmanifest in their beginning, manifest in their interim state, and unmanifest again when annihilated. So what is the need for lamentation?" In other words, you have a, if you look at it from the material point of view, you have something that comes from unmanifested circumstances. And then there's a brief period of manifestation, some life, and then it goes out of being again. So why should we lament for bodily existence? Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. You're born, you live for a while, and then you die. So, such a brief span. How many of you, when a little tiny fly or gnat gets caught in the screen, how many of you break down and cry? None of you. You just think, tiny creature, such a short life. That's the way it is, you know, and you fly into the fire as a little bug, you get caught in the screen. That's just the way it is. What about our life? Our life is so short. But because it's longer than the ant's life or the fly's life, we think our life is so significant. It's like comparing a one-hour movie to a two-hour movie. Yes? Yeah, the two-hour movie, if it's good, that's better. Even if it's really good, a three-hour movie. Yes, some of you have gone to three-hour movies before? because it's really good. You want the full experience. So, ultimately, whether it's a 3-hour movie or a 1-hour movie, it's all going to end. A few weeks ago, I was in South Africa at the University of Cape Town giving a talk, just like I'm doing now. And there was one 20-year-old lady from Botswana. It's a country just north of South Africa. Northeast of South Africa. So, very intelligent lady. So, I was impressed by her, and she was very impressed by Krishna conscious knowledge. So, I looked up. I didn't know anything about Botswana, so I looked it up in my online encyclopedia. And there I found out that the country is the diamond capital of the world for gems, not industrial diamonds, but for gem diamonds. Not South Africa, it's now Botswana. Yet, the average age of life expectancy for a man is 35 and for a woman is 36. So the next day I saw that girl and I said, from a statistical point of view, do you realize you have a life expectancy of 15 more years? She said, yes, I know that. So I said, therefore, whether you live to your 35 or live to your 75, it's just a slight difference, like between a 3-hour movie and a 1-hour movie. You must figure out what is the true course of life. What is your identity? Are you matter? Are you spirit? And what you are truly part of? You don't have very much time at all, according to statistics. And she said, you know, I was thinking the same thing. I've got to do something quick. The circumstances in my country make you think very deeply. What is it all about? Yes, that is Lord Krishna's basic message in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita. The soul, unchanging and eternal, is the actual reality. Now, Jud Bart's not finished. He's going to give a masterful dissection of the king's false ego. Rahugana, you are thinking you are the Marnik and I am the subordinate. But these roles are mere social externalities. Even in our very lifetime, these flickering positions may reverse, not to speak of in future lives. Moreover, who is actually the master? Who is the servant? Just a cursory glance at reality will reveal that everyone is under the control of nature. Try to see yourself in that way, as under the control of nature. Your body, your mind, your circumstances. You have a slight bit of independence. And it's a fact. You can see so many times someone who is the master becomes the servant. Someone who's the servant becomes the master. In politics, it happens all the time. The ins become the out become the ins. So Rahugana, Jud Bart is right to point this out to Rahugana, that you're just hung up on temporary positions which could easily change. This is a flickering reality. So, in the final stages of today's lesson, we'll look at the cycles of life. You all know these things. Birth, death, disease, and old age. What we want you to think about is how desires and karma give our current body. Only a human being can ask into this situation, inquire into this situation. We should be thinking, how do we enter this system in the first place? How do we get out of it? Why is this cycle of repeated birth and death imposed upon me? How can I escape it? And here's the argument you're going to have with mundane society, which is going to tell you, what do you care about escaping this cycle of repeated birth and death? What's the big deal? Everyone's doing it. Everyone's in ignorance. Why should you feel any different? You think they're special? Just be merry. Have as good a time as you can. Be spiritual in your own way. It'll all work out. Srimad Bhagavatam, the ancient Vedic text, points out that we gather in families like seaweed clumps together in the ocean. You can go to the shore quite easily here and see the waves bringing in the seaweed. The seaweed clumps together. The waves separate the seaweed. So when the waves separate us, our roles vanish. All the titles that we stamped ourselves with during life, when the waves of time come in, all these roles, these designations just vanish. So, what is the plain truth? This is Judd Bard, the so-called Brutus laborer. He's saying, beloved powerful ruler, you have called me a brainless fool and threatened me. If you use your executive might to crush me, will that really teach me a lesson? In other words, if you say I'm an imbecile, then what will your punishing do to me? I'm an imbecile, I'm a fool, I'm an idiot. You can't punish an idiot and expect him to learn something. So what's the use? But then the real truth, although I appear to be a muscular brute, a fool, actually, I'm fully spiritual conscious, spiritually conscious, I'm situated beyond material influence. Therefore, once again, your punishments won't affect me. So what's the use of you wasting time in this way? In other words, someone's crazy here. In a polite way, Judd Bard is saying, someone's crazy here and it's not me. Okay. We're going to halt right there. Because at this point, Rahugana is going to revive his training, the knowledge he was trained in as a youth. And when his response to all these brilliant words from Judd Bard is that he's going to immediately descend from his palanquin and fall on the ground and prostrate himself at the feet of Judd Bard. Just by hearing the words that this so-called laborer spoke, the king now realizes, this is a self-realized soul. I have made a great offense. That's another chapter. But this is real culture then. Just by hearing, the king can understand, my eyes have been mistaken. I saw a brute. But with my ears, I now understand I'm in contact with an extraordinarily elevated soul. He came down from his high chair, fell on the ground, fully prostrated at the feet of Judd Bard, begging, I can tell that you are a rare soul. Please give me knowledge. That is real culture. A far cry from what we have today. All right. So, what I have been discussing with you is basically like the first chapter of a book I've written, which is based on the Srimad Bhagavatam. I'm just giving you an appetizer so that I hope your interest in spiritual subject matter and Krishna consciousness will be stimulated. And please, you put yourself in the position of the king, Rahugana. You put yourself in the position of the laborer, Judd Bard, and think, how would you respond? Please think of it. How would I respond? So we'll stop there, because we can go on and on, but we have a schedule for tonight. Are there any questions, by the way? It's a lot to think about, I know. Okay, please think about it. And actually, if you let this information deep into the core of your being, your whole existence can be transformed. Your life might be heading in one direction, but it can go in an extraordinarily sublime direction. Just like one minute, the king is riding high on the palanquin. The next minute, he's prostrated on the ground fully in awe. I am in the presence of an extraordinarily knowledgeable person. Let me beg this person for the knowledge and for the tools and for the skills that will truly make my life successful.
Could you also put yourself into the position of the ants?
Yes. Very good. You heard what she said. And you also put yourself in the position of the ants. Of course. What is the difference in quality between the life of the ants and the life of human beings as they're living today? In fact, the human beings are unique. They're the only creature that destroys its habitat. Congratulations. Scientists are pointing that out now. Human beings have become the first creatures to alter their physical circumstances in such a hazardous way. Actually, now human beings are on par with being a geological force, a geophysical force.
The first species to survive.
Survive? Well, jury's still out on that one. Let's wait and see.
How was Earth and the Anthropomorphs? How is the fossil anthropomorphs?
How does
Earth and the Anthropomorphs?
Yes. It's imposed by nature. As soon as the body is born, it's subject to diminishment. You can look at it that instead of being one day old when you're a new baby, you're one day closer to your end. Now, you didn't ask for that. It's imposed upon you by time. Beyond time, that is the control of the Supreme. That's Krishna's control. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I am time, the destroyer of everything. In other words, time is the impersonal representation of Lord Krishna. So, nature has imposed that body on you in accordance with your past karma and your desires. So many things happen to that body, which you didn't ask for. Like, many of you know the example I like to give. When you reached 12 years or so, some change happened to your body, right? Did you ask for it? It was forced upon you, the hormones started boiling, and the rest is history, right? There's a perfect example of enslavement to nature. If you think about it, that's the fact, right? Of course, few people think about it that way. Most people think, oh, I'm 13, 14. My hormones are sizzling. Oh, this is so nice. They don't understand. This change has been forced upon them, just like disease, old age, and death. The intelligent person seeks to escape this cycle. And that is not a wrong thing to escape. That's a sign of intelligence. The escape is based on knowledge. The escape is based on a lifestyle of discipline. Then there's real pleasure. One short slogan we teach here is that there is no real pleasure without purification. In other words, purification leads to real pleasure. We have to cleanse our senses so they can actually experience the unlimited pleasure of the spirit reality. That process is Krishna consciousness. Another one.
Sorry. You're talking about knowledge and talking about beliefs as well. I said earlier that no one was told to believe anything, but then I guess we're talking about the material world or whatever, the transcendent world. To obtain knowledge through experience or through belief, like how can we actually know for sure unless we believe it? Because a lot of people believe that they know and they have knowledge, and sometimes before you have this knowledge, you have to believe that what you know is true.
Okay. Well, let's take Bhagavad Gita, for example. There, Lord Krishna says, I'm going to teach you the process by which, when you execute it, you will experience what it's like to have a consciousness harmoniously connected with me. You'll know this fully. There won't be any doubts. So Krishna's saying, I'm going to provide you a laboratory. You walk in and follow the laboratory procedure, you'll get the results. Now, is that really so difficult?
What if you don't get the results?
No, no. You try and see. And then, you can judge. Suppose I tell you, you go to Lambton Key by going out the door here, you make a left, and then a right. And what would you say then? Well, suppose I don't get the result.
Maybe. What if I took it that way? I still get there.
Are you sure? If you went that way, you'd get there?
Yeah, I might go around, and maybe get distracted by a tree along the way, and, oh, cool, a tree, and then, maybe learn a few things along the way, and all of a sudden, oh, now I'm here where I am.
It all works like that, huh?
No, but sometimes it does.
The intelligent person wants the direct, easy way, so that you don't experience any unnecessary calamities in the course of your wandering around.
If I didn't wander around a bit, I wouldn't have seen that tree and maybe taken a nap underneath it and had a cool dream.
Are you from California? I hear this a lot in California, you know? California dreaming, you know?
I'm from Canada.
Oh, I see. I can't, by the way, I can't tell North American accents. I've been away for so many decades.
Yeah.
I can't judge, you know?
No,
it all sounds Kiwi to me.
Of course you are right, mate.
You should understand that there's such a thing as lower pleasure and higher pleasure.
Right.
So, the intelligent person wants an express way to the highest pleasure.
So what is an intelligent person?
One who knows what is the best pleasure.
And so how would you know unless you believe that it's true?
You need some knowledge so you can evaluate.
And do you get this?
Why did you come to New Zealand?
So many different random reasons.
Yeah, but really, why did you come? An opportunity for what?
To come to New Zealand.
An opportunity for your senses.
Yeah.
Right. You thought it would be better here.
Not really.
A better experience. Otherwise, you wouldn't have come.
No, actually.
You didn't say, I'm going to go to New Zealand to suffer. But you are hoping for some adventure, yes?
For adventure, but adventure doesn't always mean something positive.
But still, you thought this would be an addition to your life.
It was time frame.
Anyway, you know what I mean. So,
not really, that's why I'm asking.
Okay. You have to understand that there are different levels of pleasure, and it's your job as a human being to get the highest possible level.
Is that my job?
Yes. Because the living entity is eternally pleasure-seeking. That is the characteristic of the soul. Always pleasurable.
Is this according to nature that we are
yes.
forced upon?
It's your constitutional position that you're always looking for pleasure.
Under whose constitution?
Ah, it's a good question. Very good. So, as we explained, you are a tiny part. Now, what is the complete whole that you are part of? That kind of knowledge is Krishna consciousness. It's not enough to know that you are spirit soul. You also have to know what is the spiritual whole that you're a part of, and what's the relationship between that whole and the part. Then you're truly holistic. You may notice everyone uses the word holistic, but no one knows anything about the complete whole. Slight problem, you know? A little minor problem.
Right, but this concept of wholes and parts, right?
Mm-hmm.
Could that also be one of those sort of pop, like, trendy? I know what you said before. I know you're sort of being a little, like, sarcastic.
No.
Said something about these, like, really trendy concepts and belief systems and stuff, mm-hmm. but the concept of this whole and this part, mm-hmm. could that not be one of those trendy concepts as well? Mm-hmm.
So therefore you have to evaluate yourself. You have to evaluate yourself. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, you do like this, and you'll be conscious of what is the situation. So that's fair enough, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Okay.
So could you achieve this, maybe when you are actually a transcendent being completely, maybe this whole idea of wholes and parts is even more irrelevant than...
Then what? Than you are the everything, right? Ah, you are moving the sun, you are moving the moon.
You don't even need to pay attention to the sun, it's a physical thing.
I am you and you are me and we are all the one, right?
The whole and the parts.
But what are we a part of something or are we the everything? Are you the everything?
Well,
yes or no?
I can't escape the fact that I breathe oxygen that could also be part of the tree in 10,000 years and all that sort of thing.
But answer me this. Are you the complete everything? That means then you're part of something, right?
But I'm not a part, because constantly there's things falling off of me and becoming part of other things.
Regardless of how you put it, you're not the complete everything, right?
No.
Okay, that means you're part of something, whether you say you're part of the cycles of nature or whatever, you're part of something, right?
Yeah, regardless, this concept could not even be relevant to, you know, our soul, our actual, what we're trying to achieve here, this spiritual transcendence, these abstract ideas, probably irrelevant to, like, even our discussion. You could just be sitting here completely silent. And you transcend me. It doesn't matter. Oh, I'm breathing, I'm physical, I've got these things moving around, but it doesn't matter. It's my body.
Right, so
we don't even need to even have this.
Oh, then why'd you come? Good. That's quite all right. We don't mind. We got food here that is cooked by very purified persons. We have an enlightened kitchen. So very soon you'll be experiencing the results of the enlightened kitchen. Okay? Yeah, I'm into that too.
What would you say is important whilst choosing your spiritual path? And do you think it's necessary to follow one path only, at least for a while?
Well, what do you hope to achieve?
Good question.
All right, let me give you a practical example. Seated here is a medical doctor of many of the practitioners here, Dr. Daniel. Now, suppose, let's say I go to Dr. Daniel and he gives me a prescription. And I say, well, that's very nice, but other paths I can take. Now, would you think I would be an effective patient in that way? Take this. I want you to take one pill a day and report back to me in 3 months. Thank you very much. That sounds very good, but what about other paths? What about other doctors? Actually, I've got an appointment with another doctor tomorrow, another one the next day, and I'll just take a little bit from each.
Okay, so that brings me back to the first one.
Yeah.
Yeah, what would be important for you if you would be able to choose?
For me?
Yeah.
I've got to have the best knowledge and the best pleasure. I don't settle for any less. That was my ambition since, you know, the age of 22 when I embarked upon this spiritual journey. I was looking for the most comprehensive spiritual knowledge and the greatest pleasure. At university, my friends all knew that I was a pleasure lover. But I began to reflect. I don't think my reputation is true, because I don't know pleasure that has no beginning or end. Where is that? So, you should think like that also. And that will cause you to try for the most comprehensive, exhaustive spiritual knowledge that's available to you. There are different degrees of knowledge. It's not a question of this one is going to be right, that one's going to be wrong. It's just a degree of comprehensiveness and completeness. So if you ask me, I'll tell you that you won't find any knowledge, any spiritual knowledge, more comprehensive and exhaustive than Krishna conscious knowledge. Of course, you may ask, well, have you ever looked at everything else? Yes. Okay? Glad you have a sense of humor. All right. I think what do we have next?
My question is a little bit more specific, and it's more to do with the soul. I understand that we are simply physical representation of the soul, and I understand that we are also little flames to a big fire. I understand that concept. I understand that we live in a physical reality around us, and everything around us is physical. But what I want to know is, what is your understanding of what the soul actually is? I mean, if the soul is not made up of physical nature, then is it antimatter? Or?
That's a good way of putting it. That's a very good way of putting it. Antimatter. Not antimatter as scientists may use the word, but is definitely the opposite qualities of matter. No temporality, no limitation. So, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that the soul is a particle of consciousness, is indestructible. It is what animates the body. Now, if you know anything about science, you'll know that there's not one scientific instrument throughout the whole world that can directly detect the presence of consciousness. The fact that consciousness is such a riddle to material science should let you know that there is a part of you that is not amenable to material explanation. And then once you go in that direction, then you start thinking, what is the nature of the supreme consciousness? Because you're not everything, you're a tiny part. So what is the source of all consciousness? Well, therefore, Bhagavad Gita is very, very rewarding, because it, right in the beginning, it brings you to the point of understanding individual consciousness and the supreme consciousness and the relationship between the two. This is the most desperately needed knowledge today. A very good question.
Thank you.
Okay.
There was another question.
All right.
I don't know if I understand you correctly. What you're really saying is that true happiness, bliss, comes from not being, not from achieving your materialistic goals, but from something else. So I just need to ask you, as someone practicing Hare Krishna, are you free of all material desires? Or how do you apply the Hare Krishna to living your lifestyle? Is your happiness life just comes from, I don't know, whatever? Or material goals?
That for your goals?
I don't know, just from your own goals. Like, for example, I'm traveling here, so...
Where are you from?
Israel.
I'm going there in July.
Really?
Yeah. I go everywhere in the world. I've been traveling for 25 years. On every continent. I haven't been to Israel yet, though. So, yes?
Yeah, so, I mean, according to what you're saying, you should just abandon all our, all our goals and, I don't know.
Did I say that?
That's more or less what I understand.
No. I'm saying that we should seek out a lifestyle of discipline and purification so that we can actually have real knowledge and real pleasure. I didn't say anything about abandoning your home or abandoning your occupation. I'm just pointing out what's the most important thing. Now, I know I have a watch. I travel on airplanes. I haven't abandoned these things, but hopefully I'm using these things for the highest purpose. So it's not a question of abandoning, it's a question of proper utilization. Yeah. It's like, for example, we'll go back to our friend, Dr. Daniel. He's qualified in so many alternative medical practices. He also knows conventional medicine. Now, he's a Krishna conscious practitioner. Has he thrown away his occupation? No. He can just actually do the highest service for society by being able to spot persons' material problems and their spiritual problems. Similarly, when I was in university, supposedly I was good at writing. I write books now. If I don't write books anymore, it just wastes people's time. I seek to write books that give the most valuable information. So it's not a question of giving up. It is a question of using what you have for the greatest purpose. You must have some skills that you can use for the greatest purpose. Yes?
Yeah, I mean, according to what you're saying, the true happiness comes not from achieving ordinary goals, but, I don't know, from arriving.
That's true. Okay. Yeah. Like what? Give me an example of an ordinary goal. These are good questions. What's the example?
I don't know.
What would you like to achieve?
I don't know. Have a nice meal now. Whatever, you know?
That's easy. You just come here. No problems. Easily achieved. See how easy it is?
I mean, the true happiness comes from achieving, spiritual goals. Why not become a monk and, you know, and do nothing and eat rice and,
you know, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I take umbrage to that. Wait a minute. Hold on there. Become a monk and just eat rice and do nothing. Biases? I've already told you. I traveled to every continent of the world. I've been doing that for 25 years. And now you're telling me I'm a monk who just eats rice and does nothing?
I mean, I'm just saying why not become a monk because
someone who knows, someone who actually has knowledge, is the most active because such a person can actually give real benefit to other people. Why should activity be the monopoly of persons who have no idea what they're doing? You're a real extremist, aren't you?
Sorry.
In any case, try to understand this. Why should someone who has real knowledge be inactive?
Well, because, I mean, I don't know, you say, I don't know how you achieve real happiness, but you seem more happy than, you know, ordinary people.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, your happiness doesn't what? Come from, I don't know, earning money or going on vacation or, I don't know, whatever. Your true happiness comes from something else, and why do all the other things? You know, why not do whatever it is that makes you be real happy?
You can be a specialist in the topmost happiness if you so desire. There's always specialists in every field. But, you know, also there are persons who, they have a lesser degree of specialization. Just like in Israel, there are many Krishna conscious practitioners and they, you know, of course, they're working, they're raising a family, but they know what the most important thing is. Every field needs professors. You might consider I'm just a professor. But it doesn't mean that everyone has to be a professor. you'll benefit so much by applying these things we're talking about in your life. Even as you work and as you live at home. Okay? It's just a question of connecting everything to the highest purpose, whether you have a family or you're earning money. What's the purpose of it all?
And what purpose is it all?
And
what is the purpose of it all?
You tell me. What's the purpose of it all? You're a student or you're working?
I don't know. I came here for your lecture.
Okay, I will. We'll talk afterwards, okay? You can tell me all about Israel. I haven't been there before. All right. We could go on talking all night, but time is a bit short. So, what happens next? All right, we're going to have some spiritual sound vibration. And then there'll be the delicious banquet of exquisite taste. Okay, thank you very much. Adios.